Well, good day and welcome back to another episode here of the Disaster Podcast. I'm your host, Jamie Davis, the Pod Medic, and it's great to have everybody joining us again this week. Boy, we've had some good episodes and topics over the recent couple of weeks, and part of that is due to the amazing efforts of my co-host, Sam Bradley, who just always pulls together some great topics for us to have on the show. Hey, Sam.
Hey there, Jamie. Well, you guys help a lot, too. You and Joe always come off with some great recommendations that, work really well. We've had a kind of an interesting group of subjects here lately. Last week, we talked about the Zika virus.
That was such a great episode. I've known Vince for a long time since he started podcasting, and you know, I started gathering together a group of medical and health related podcasters, and his shows on virology and parasitism and microbiology are just fantastic. And he's always my go-to guy whenever there's a virus outbreak somewhere in the world.
Well, it's so cool that he's not only an expert, but he podcasts. I mean, you don't usually see that. Somebody who's interested enough in getting information out to the public that he's got like five different podcasts on all these different subjects around virology and bugs. And it's just fascinating. So he's just a great resource. We're lucky to have somebody like that out there.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So, you know, folks, if you haven't checked out that episode on the Zika virus with Vince Racaniello from Columbia University, you need to check it out. It's last week's episode here at disasterpodcast.com. And if you hear something there, you want to ask it a question, you can always leave a comment on the site and we'll get Vince to come back over and answer any questions you have. Just a great resource. We're glad to have him on. But we've got another whole topic we're covering tonight. And Sam, why don't you introduce our guest and we can go ahead and jump in.
Yeah, this is a whole different idea. And we're kind of moving back into the disaster arena. And there's a lot of things that we don't have out there. I mean, we have the basic types of things we need. And we actually do a pretty good job, especially on the DMAT side, as far as what we have, what we create when we put our tent together that is a mini hospital, if you will. Less so USAR, because they more engage in getting people out, getting them to us. But one of the things that we don't have much ability to use as an ultrasound. So in those situations where we need to do some diagnostic things, we don't actually have that. And Dan told us he came to us, and that's actually what he does. So he's going to tell us a little bit about that, what he has and what he does. And where did that go? Dan Taylor, tell us about yourself. We want to learn what you can tell us.
Hi, so my name is Dantel. I'm a civilian medic. I've been in EMS for about 10 years at this point. I work as a ski patroller and an educator for Upstate's hospital's EMT program. I've held a number of different roles from training to clinical roles in hospital, out of, and I found myself increasingly interested in disaster medicine, wilderness, and austere environments. And so that's led me to pursue training on my own and with other groups. And I'm a member of Team Rubicon, which is a disaster relief organization that's done work domestically and internationally. And in my paramedic class, I was introduced to the idea of pre-hospital ultrasound. And at that point, I really had no idea that ultrasound was as potentially useful as it really is, or that it was something that EMS could even start using. The program director has been a longtime ultrasound evangelist and really sold all of us and a lot of people on the region in the region on the power of it. And I don't have a ton of clinical experience with the ultrasound itself. It's something that I've read quite a bit about, and in some of my work doing training development and special event medicine, special event consulting, I've seen applications for it, and I think it's a very powerful tool and something that can really be pretty multifaceted in an austere environment or a disaster, giving us significantly greater capability than we might have without it.
Well, especially in an environment where, you know, because we have different situations, and in some cases local hospitals are functional, in other cases they aren't. Certainly looking at Katrina, we were pretty much all there was. So if we don't have it, it isn't going to be had. So that eliminates a lot of ability to do some diagnostics. And what kind of things do you envision this would be useful for those that aren't terribly educated on ultrasound?
Yeah, so broadly speaking, I think one of the best things that we can do with it is using it as a triage tool to recognize who may be quite critical or potentially critical, who needs to be evacuated sooner rather than later, and then differentiate some minor issues from potentially more significant ones. So specifically, one of the potential uses is identifying increased ICP, potentially even before the patient has their vital signs have reacted. Even identifying a fracture could be a useful tool in a wilderness or austere setting where we're differentiating between ankle pain versus potentially a hairline or a complete fracture. And that can be done with an ultrasound unit and, in fact, just a small handheld ultrasound unit. Some other really useful applications of the ultrasound, obviously things like confirming ET placement, which might not be really key in a disaster. We're probably not going to be intubating a ton of people. The folks that need that probably aren't going to last long enough for the providers to get there. But there are certainly instances where DMATs and other fairly rapid response teams end up setting up quite critical care-like environments in austere environments, whether it be domestically or internationally. So some other kind of specific uses for ultrasound, identifying a pneumothorax, whether it's a noisy environment or, you know, sometimes it may just be difficult to detect that there's not lung sounds there. And it might be a nice extra confirmation that we do in fact have a pneumo and potentially prevent the patient from getting an unnecessary decompression. And then you're looking at the risk of infection associated with that. We can also look at fluid administration and a patient's fluid status. So not only preventing fluid overload, but actually managing the supplies that we have. So if we don't have to give as much fluid to a patient because we can look at their heart and look at their fluid status and determine that maybe a 250 or 500 cc bolus is going to be adequate, maybe we don't have to use as much of a quite limited amount of fluid we may have. So those are a few specific things. I mean, people are probably familiar with using it in the setting of trauma for a FAST exam, looking at the presence of free fluid and identifying that potentially maybe there's some intra-abdominal trauma that's causing bleeding. And that would be a good reason for a patient to get evacuated either to an actually hospital or something more like a military mass cache type facility.
Well, that makes perfect sense because so much of what we do in that environment is guesswork. And, you know, you can't see what you can't see. And ironically, I also used to do ski patrol for 15 years. So even in that environment where it's quite austere and you're quite a ways away from a hospital, it's the same kind of guesswork, making the decision on how and how quickly and where you need to send somebody. Do they need to go to a trauma center? Do they not? So this sounds like a great tool. So you're talking about the GEV scan. You're saying, and I'm just kind of referring back to your email, this is a fairly small device because when I think ultrasounds, I'm thinking like huge. And you say it has a 60-minute battery life, which is pretty good in a disaster situation.
Yeah, I don't have firsthand experience with the GEV scan, but I believe it is one of the smallest, if not the smallest, on the market. I know I sent you guys a link for an emergency medicine physician who did a really great review with his hands-on experience, and he had a pretty favorable opinion of it. But yeah, the GEV scan comes with a dual probe, so you've got both a phase probe and a linear probe. Which some devices require different probes to get different images. This one has one built in that does both. 60-minute battery life, as you mentioned, that's according to the GE specs. And I mean, if you're thinking a 24 to 48 hour disaster, 60 minutes might be great. If we're thinking something like the Nepal earthquake, you know, maybe 60 minutes is not ideal. But I mean, with the availability of solar power and with other options, I think the potential issue of the battery draining can be mitigated, and the fact that this device really gives us a pretty wide variety of abilities might counteract the issue with the power there. And it's a really fairly small device, and there's some great YouTube videos of physicians using it in a clinical environment and in a kind of a trade floor environment where you can really see just how small this thing is that It looks kind of like a small laptop. It's only maybe 5 or 6 inches wide. It flips open to reveal the screen and the very simple keypad, and then it's got a small probe connected to it.
And it seems like that this would, you know, even with a 1 hour battery life, it's something you can turn on, turn off, do your exam, and then shut it down until the next person comes along that needs the specific exam. So it's not something you'd use on every patient, but it would be used as an excellent option to rule out or diagnostically confirm or, you know, whatever it is you're looking for.
Absolutely. And one of the great things about the training for this, the kind of training that I've had and that other agencies are deploying, is that with fairly limited, there was one study that looked at a pilot program in San Antonio that did 2 hours of training for paramedics, and they were able to, or I believe it was 19 of the 20 paramedics involved, so not a giant sample size, but still something. 19 of the 20 were able to identify the presence of a pneumothorax, a pericardial effusion, and cardiac standstill, which could be useful for terminating resuscitation efforts. So limited training will also, or any more training will also drop potentially the amount of time it takes to do these exams. So somebody who maybe is on a DMAT or who knows they're going to be using this device in an austere setting, if they do a 1 day course or a 2 day course, they're going to get even more proficient. And now you're going from particularly longer exam times during the battery to a much shorter, quicker exam that gives you quite a bit of information.
And on the DMAT team, Sam, you guys have people with a lot of clinical experience, so it wouldn't be unheard of to have somebody there who already has ultrasound experience.
Oh, yeah. We have a lot of mid-levels and physicians. And I'm thinking if this is adopted by the federal government to be used in our cash, then virtually everyone all the way down to EMT will be taught how to use it. That's how we roll. So, and we were talking about paramedic level education. This isn't something that's been prevalent in our curriculum because we've never had a device that we could use that did this. But I can see this in the future as something very viable and added to the paramedic curriculum.
Well, entitled capnography wasn't there in the beginning either. And,
true.
And it was added in, and now people can read waveforms. They can use it for a whole lot of other additional things that, beyond just confirming tube placement with a few numbers, while this is a little more in depth than that, it's not, you know, it didn't take anybody that long to figure out how to use end-tidal capnography either as a new technology once it was available routinely in the field and became the standard of practice. So again, as I think, you know, as Daniel says, this is something that is so portable that it would be something that, at least in the critical care setting or flight paramedic setting, would be something that someone would be trained on. Do you see that, Daniel?
I know a few services have started using ultrasound for critical care transport, be it ground or aeromedical. Previous service I worked for was a ground-based EMS agency that did also staff a sheriff's office helicopter. And the medical director in that system was very progressive and was definitely pushing for the use of ultrasound. It hasn't really made its way to upstate New York widespread yet. There's two paramedic programs that are doing that have included it in their curriculum. And so the training is starting to happen. And I think as more people do the training, both on the paramedic side and on the physician side, so we're seeing it, point of care ultrasound becoming increasingly common in the ED and other settings, that more services will recognize that this is a tool that they can add to the toolbox. I know I've heard arguments that, well, you need to have a license to use it, and that's not accurate, or that they're too bulky, and as we've discussed, clearly not an issue, that they're too complicated, also not an issue, and of course, people have said they're too expensive. You can get a refurbished GEV scan for under $5,000, so you know, maybe it's not something that a person's going to go out and buy themselves, but it certainly could be feasible for an aeromedical program or for an agency to pick a few of these up.
Jamie, it sounds like something we ought to look for when we're in Baltimore.
Yeah, we'll have to see. This is a new technology for the field, and it'll be interesting to see if there's anything down there. I know a few years ago, I forget which conference it was at, but there was an all-in-one heart monitor unit that was advertising that it included ultrasound technology as part of the package that could be added on as an add-on. So that it, you know, it was able to do, it was basically a hospital wall monitor type device that had been compressed down into a portable field medics unit. But it did, interestingly enough, because it was kind of in that form factor and those, that use profile, it didn't have the ability to cardiovert or shock built into it. So it was really just it was really just thought of as a portable monitor diagnostic tool. It wasn't thought of as a treatment tool. And so what they were looking at when we talked to them and asked that very question was, well, can you add defibrillation and cardioversion technology? Because that would be something that would be a non-starter if you didn't have it in the EMS sector. It's great to have a monitor. We've already got monitors. Our monitors may not do all the things yours do, but they do the two most important things we need to be able to do, which is cardiovert and shock. But they had the option to have ultrasound. So the capabilities of adding these in as modules to our existing equipment is out there. And it's likely that we may see this added to standard heart monitor capability. We already have them that have capnography added to them. They have pulse oximetry added to them. Why not have ultrasound technology added as well? What do you think about that, Daniel?
I think it would be quite interesting to see maybe 5-10 years where we have a monitor that does all of that and more. I think especially with the monitors that have the ability to transmit a 12 lead or other information directly to a hospital, that adding that in with ultrasound and really increasing the fidelity of the information that the hospital is receiving from the paramedics would be quite useful, really increasing or really improving the connection between the physician and the paramedic. And it's as the technology becomes more available, less expensive, and smaller, I think it's entirely feasible to think that we could have ultrasound integrated into a monitor. But even the devices that are available now as a standalone device, I think it's fantastic to have it out there. You know, for a disaster or austere setting, maybe a DMAT. I don't know if you guys are using a full heart monitor routinely.
Yes, yes.
Okay. But I'm thinking in a setting where people are going to be hiking into get to a casualty or I mean, again, like the Nepal earthquake or some of these other very severe natural disasters in a, you know, pretty rugged region, I don't want to be carrying a life pack 15 on my back. That's right. A lot.
Well, mostly what a DMAT does is we move into a standalone facility. Now, it doesn't mean that we may not have teams that may go out into the wild, and we do have some more portable equipment for that use. But I can see where the USARs are concerned, where they would need more lightweight type equipment because they're going to carry a certain amount with them when they go do rescues, and then so they can resuscitate those people before they try to get them to us. But you know, I want to throw out a question for both of you, just sort of being the devil's advocate here a little bit. But where I can see this is going to help as a medic, and all three of us are, this will help me decide whether I'm in a DMAT situation or in the field. Does this guy need to go to a trauma center? You know, what level of injury does he have? And I can make a quick decision on that. But you know that there are going to be naysayers that are going, well, you know, you people just do way too much in the field. You just need to get these people to the hospital and let the people in the hospital deal with that kind of thing. What do you think about that, Dan? Have you heard anything around that?
Absolutely. I think some of the same arguments were made when 12 leads were first becoming common in EMS, that this may not necessarily change our pre-hospital treatment, but it's going to change the information we're able to provide to the hospital, and it may ensure that the patient gets to the right hospital. As you pointed out, you know, going to a community level facility versus a level one trauma center could be quite significant. And we see this now happening with 12 leads, where we're recognizing that it's in fact a STEMI and they're going to a hospital that's equipped to take care of them versus sitting in a facility and then waiting for transfer. I think we could see that absolutely the same thing in a non-disaster, just typical civilian EMS setting, motor vehicle accident in the back in a kind of more rural area. Maybe they have a little bit of abdominal pain from possibly the seatbelt. Is it just a mark from the seatbelt, or, you know, do they actually have a more significant injury? I think we can equip our providers to make really good informed decisions quite quickly. And in some cases, maybe they do this en route. They start going to a facility or start heading in a general direction and then say, you know what, we do need, in fact, to go a little bit further to that level one to make sure that this patient gets the care they need in a timely fashion.
Yeah, I think that this is an important topic. And actually, I'll take the 10,000-foot view. We're in a nation right now, as a country, talking about healthcare reform and keeping costs under control and managing the effectiveness of treatments to the individual patient rather than taking a cookie cutter approach. And this is one of those ways we could potentially do that. Think about the people that are sent by aeromedical transport because of suspected trauma injuries due to mechanism only. And for people that don't live in states like Maryland, where that transport is free because it's provided by the state police, if you go to most places, that's a $20,000, $30,000 transport sometimes that the patient's insurance doesn't always pay. And it ends up falling to the patient to pay for something that they may not have needed and could have been, if they had the ultrasound technology, diagnostically ruled out. And they could have just gone to the local medical center or local community hospital for treatment. So this is something I think that, you know, we need to demonstrate the cost effectiveness of having this device from a cost savings standpoint as well, in that we are saving both the patient, the insurance companies, and the state health system resources and managing those resources more effectively.
Really good point on that, Jamie. And it just sounds like there needs to be a whole lot more education on this topic and looking at some of the things we're talking about tonight. I can see a lot of advantages to this, but I think there are a lot of people that are going to need to be convinced, like you were saying.
Yeah, and it seems like it's starting to happen in small kind of pockets here and there, whether it's a pilot study or whether it's a single paramedic program that builds it into the curriculum. I know there are some fire departments and EMS agencies and aeromedical services across the U.S. that have picked it up. It's obviously still not widespread, but at least some people are talking about it. And I think with the foam movement of open access to education, and in particular medical education, it's becoming easier to learn about ultrasound, learn how to use it, learn how to use it in different and creative ways. And I think we're starting to break down some of the barriers from where it used to only be a physician skill or something that someone was looking at a 2 or 4 year degree to become a sonographer, to now being another tool that we can use. I know there's at least one medical school that has started issuing ultrasounds to their students as one of the primary diagnostics that they expect the students to be using. So I think as EMS picks it up a little bit and as more medical institutions start using it as point of care and it becomes much more common, that we're going to see people not just asking for it, but insisting on it and expecting it.
Well, and one thing we didn't bring up, which I think is a huge possibility, I've been doing some work in the education on community paramedicine. And I really see, especially when you have some kind of visual link with a physician, where maybe you can communicate what you're seeing in terms of making decisions on where people should go and so forth. I think that's another real big possibility here for the future is in community paramedicine.
Well, and you've got the diagnostic capabilities of detecting fetal heart tones and things like that, so that you can, you can verify a fetal viability during a emergency maternity call, or in the case of community paramedics, a routine visit during pregnancy when there's not visiting nurses available to make those assessments. So there's all kinds of things that can be done with ultrasound that we're just really scratching the surface right now. Wouldn't you agree, Daniel?
Absolutely. I think it's a very useful device that has quite a number of capabilities, and especially when you start connecting, you have a paramedic using it and you connect a physician on the other end, potentially guiding that paramedic to go even further, we quite dramatically expand the capabilities. And as the cost of the technology drops and it becomes more readily available and the quality of it becomes better, I think we're going to see hopefully more use. And one application I didn't mention, and it may be a little further off, but there's been some research about using really local ultrasound-guided nerve blocks for pain management of extremity fractures. I think that would be a fantastic way to get some relief for some of our pre-hospital patients, where maybe we, for one reason or another, don't have or don't want to use a narcotic. We can do a local nerve block, ultrasound guided, in most parts of the body. It can be done quite safely with pretty limited risks to the patient. And I know there was at least one study that's looked at the military's use of this, that special forces medics have done nerve blocks in different forms for a while, some ultrasound guided, some not. And in a disaster setting, that could be very useful. We're going to have a very limited quantity of narcotic pain medication, if we have it at all. But lidocaine, we probably have some of that. So we may be able to create some significant relief without the overall effects that we get with other meds.
You know, Sam, I'm thinking we should have had Seth Hawkins on this one.
We may have to do that.
Wilderness medicine and his applications of wilderness and high altitude mountain medicine to see what he thinks about this possibility, because I'm sure he would appreciate talking about it as well. We'll have to have you back on again, Daniel.
Sure. It's something I definitely want to see a lot more of.
And I'm thinking, too, that Dr. Joe can have a good time with this. He likes to get new equipment out there in his different labs and give people the opportunity to play with it and see what it does and maybe spread the word. This is a good thing.
Definitely. So, Daniel, is there a place where people can find more information about what you're talking about and how they can learn more about ultrasound in the pre-hospital or austere setting?
Absolutely. So the first resource I would suggest is paramedicultrasound.com. That's run by the director of the Monroe Community College Paramedic Program. He was the one who taught me about ultrasound and gave me my hands-on experience with it. That's Peter Bonadonna, a fantastic instructor, fantastic friend of EMS. He's an active provider. So paramedicultrasound.com has a lot of great information, and he also leads with all the reasons it won't work and then very quickly debunks those. And then he's also got a lot of information about other systems that have used it, the training, the research that's been done about training paramedics on it. So that's one fantastic resource. There's also ultrasoundoftheweek.com, which has some pretty cool stuff. They always have some great pictures and videos of ultrasounds, and then they'll give you a little patient scenario. And then you can get the diagnosis and a little pearl of wisdom about that as well. So those would be two kind of quick resources I would suggest. And then doing a search on the iTunes store for pre-hospital ultrasound or just ultrasound will often come up with some of the great foam resources that are out there. And Ultrasound 101 is an episode of one particular podcast. I think it's the EM Resident podcast, and that gives a really good under, I think, 30 or 40 minute crash course in the how and the why of ultrasound. And it's a really great way to kind of understand why it works and how it works and some of the different ways we can use it.
Excellent. Well, we will definitely include those links in the show notes for this episode. And then, Daniel, thanks for coming on. Sam, where can people find you if they want to reach out to you in between episodes of the show?
Well, Sam Bradley or Sam Bradley 11, Twitter, Facebook, and so forth, the usual places, and thedisasterpodcast.com. And hopefully maybe Seth is listening to this and we can get him interested in coming back on with Dan.
That would be great. Well, folks, that's going to wrap up this episode. You can always find me over at where I am. That's all right.
Your sixth podcast, Jamie.
It's been a long day. You can find me under the handle Podmedic, of course, on most social media sites. So look me up, friend me, follow me, or whatever else over on those social media channels. And of course, you can always find me here at disasterpodcast.com. We want to thank our sponsors, Paragon Medical Education Group, without whom this podcast would not be possible. They make it all happen And they do that as well in their amazing experiential training programs for disaster response across all levels. And this is, when I say all levels, I mean from police, fire, EMS, health department, hospital setting. They pull entire areas of jurisdictions together for experiential training, where it's not just death by PowerPoint. It is the actual hands-on work where they bring in even cadavers so that you can get hands-on tissue adaptation of your skills, where you're using actual physical human tissue to make a tourniquet work or try a new tool. And they're always great about bringing new things out there. So check them out at ParagonMedicalGroup.com. Find out what you can do to bring this kind of training into your system. I promise you, you won't be sorry. Sam, you know, ultrasounds, we've been talking Zika in previous weeks. There's all kinds of stuff, but it all comes back to disaster medicine.
It does. And another thing I'm looking forward to is next week, Dr. Joe's got some real exciting stuff. Paragon, they're having an active shooter drill, which sold out very early. So I think it's something that they're going to be doing regularly, I hope. And we're looking forward to checking up with them and taking some pictures and seeing how that all worked out. So that's just another exciting thing we have to look forward to. But, you know, as usual, we have had a good couple weeks on educating ourselves and other people on things that are just new and different. And it just shows you how much there is to know, because disaster medicine is not our everyday medicine.